Well, as much as I hate to cut it short, we got to get out of here. Make way for Dave Emery. Music from 1980 from Total Freewheelin', punk rock band from Czechoslovakia. Wow, called Zikarat. Studio live recordings, from which we heard Utsisti Sol, Zikarat. There's a great 30-minute track we're going to have to throw in next week, I think. From Zikarat. Brand new from Hella behind that. New on the 5RC label, Hold Your Horse Is. Weird brown metal. Ceramic Hobbs out of England did Irreversible Liver Failure from a record called Psychiatric Underground. Joshua Burkett from his new record, Gold Cosmos. Some beautiful vocals from Dread Fool and guitar work from Ben from Six Organs of Admittance. Brand new, also, a weird Spider Walks Web from Joshua Burkett, a record Gold Cosmos. And Hoy Voodoo from an unknown titled 7-inch, new out of Japan. All here on WFMU East Orange, WXHD Mount Hope, on the internet at WFMU.org. This is Brian. I'll see you all next Tuesday, 3 to 6 p.m. Thanks again, Acid Mother's Temple, for an amazing set today. And thanks for tuning in. Stay tuned. Dave Emery is up next. Mac with the Antique Phonograph Music Program at 7, and Sue Braun at 8 o'clock for Tom Sharpling. Have a great week, everybody.
Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 348, titled Machiavelli 101. This is being recorded on February 17th of 2002, and it is yet another broadcast dealing with the events in and around and following, and in some cases preceding, the terrorist blitzkrieg of September 11th, 2001. We're going to be looking in this broadcast at a convergence between sort of cynical, opportunistic, no-brainer approaches to policy, or at least what are hypothesized as that, and also deep Machiavellian cynical power ploys in realpolitik. What I'm going to suggest, and this will appear remarkable to some listeners, is that this will that I suspect that certain elements are operating opportunistically, and that within that context, certain other elements, particularly elements that I have termed the Underground Reich, literally a Third Reich gone underground and perpetuated in mafia-like style underground from the end of World War II, I will suggest that whereas some elements have been operating opportunistically and with a very short-sighted perspective, others have been operating within that context in a very cynical and deliberate and far-sighted perspective. Long-range perspective would be a better word. One could perhaps compare this convergence with the way a mosquito transmits malaria. It's not out to transmit malaria, it's out to suck blood, but when it bites more than one victim, it winds up transmitting the organism and spreading the disease, and I think that's a good metaphor. We're going to begin by looking at an excerpt from a book we've used many times in the recent past. It's called Dollars for Terror, subtitled The United States and Islam. It's authored by Richard LaBeviere, translated by Martin Demare. The book was published in softcover by Algora Publishers. You can visit their website at www.algora.com. The ISBN number is 1-892941-06-6. The book was originally published in French in 1999 and published by Algora in English in 2000. In a chapter ironically called Is There a Pilot on Board the U.S. Aircraft?, referring to questions concerning the direction and stability of U.S. policy, the author describes in an excerpt that we've used previously the baklavization of American foreign policy, where there are various competing elements at different levels, which produces something analogous to a baklava pastry. We're going to also take a look here at discussion by the author of the conflict or the convergence between short-sighted and very unwise policy and a carefully constructed Machiavellism, as he calls it. Big brother or a ship without a rudder? It's hard to tell, especially when one is analyzing Islamism as seen from Washington. Illustrating the pragmatism inspired by Anglo-Saxon virtues in the field of international relations, an eminent advisor to the State Department today asserts, quote, the need for an incoherent foreign policy, unquote. The same man recognizes off-camera that in these matters the Secret Service, translation the intelligence services, has more power than the State Department. If you want to understand that, he says, just look at Irangate, a typical scandal. We'll come back to the Iran-Contra scandal later on in the program. Continuing, although a major shakeup ensued within the U.S. intelligence services, that did not change a thing in terms of the international tribulations of the world's primary power, which continuously oscillates between improvisation with no thought for tomorrow and a carefully constructed Machiavellism. Now, in previous discussion of Richard Labeyrière's book, we've taken a look at the information he has presented, which alleges profound support for al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, not only from Saudi Arabia, but also by a faction of U.S. intelligence associated with the petroleum industry. And what we're going to be looking at in some of the first part of this broadcast is the apparent use, hypothesized to a certain extent by Richard Labeyrière, of al-Qaeda as basically a geopolitical lever for corporate interests, which are interested in extracting wealth and consequently utilizing al-Qaeda in a cynical geopolitical fashion, which is at the same time relatively short-sighted and also in some ways Machiavellian. I would suggest that within that context, there is another element at work, namely the Underground Reich, which is not only looking to develop resources, but which is looking to turn world opinion against the United States and ultimately to destroy or isolate and neutralize American power, and also to annihilate Israel and wipe out world Jewry. Again, the Underground Reich. Taking a look now at one of the Machiavellian applications of al-Qaeda, in the past we've taken a look at the relationship between al-Qaeda and Saudi intelligence, and in turn and by extension elements of U.S. intelligence associated with the petroleum industry. The New York Times of Friday, January 18th of 2002, had an op-ed column by Richard Butler, who is a scholar in residence at the Council on Foreign Relations and has recently published a paper called Fatal Choice, Nuclear Weapons and the Illusion of Missile Defense. The CFR, of course, a major geopolitical think tank with close connections to the Rockefeller interests. This op-ed column is called A New Oil Game with New Winners, and it refers to the traditional great game, a policy of geopolitics played in the 19th century between the British and Russian empires, and talking about the collapse of the Soviet Union, and something that we've looked at in For the Record programs 328 and 334, namely the fact that UNICAL and British Petroleum and the Saudis are planning on putting a pipeline through Afghanistan in order to, and Pakistan also, by the way, in order to basically take oil from the Caspian Sea and market it. Bear in mind that the elder George Bush has a very heavy investment in UNICAL. Richard Butler writes, the war in Afghanistan is most relevant in two respects. First, it has made the construction of a pipeline across Afghanistan and Pakistan politically possible for the first time since UNICAL and the Argentinian company Bridas competed for the Afghan rights in the mid-1990s. And I would suggest that there are elements, and in a future broadcast called Timeline, I'm going to review some of the very disturbing indications that some elements of our national security establishment had forewarning of September 11th. We're going to be taking a look at reviewing some of those indications in a future broadcast. Now, thinking in terms of relatively cynical and short-sighted geopolitics, and specifically utilizing Al-Qaeda and Islamism or Islamic fundamentalism as a lever through which either areas could be split off so that their natural resources could be utilized, or which could be used to coerce certain areas into allowing the development of natural resources by in multinational corporate interests. One of the areas where Islamic fundamentalism and also elements of Al-Qaeda have been very active has been in China, specifically in Xinjiang province, and I may be mispronouncing that, X-I-N-J-I-A-N-G. That is a resource-rich province, and it also has a very large Muslim population called the Uyghurs, U-I-G-H-U-R. Turning again to Dollars for Terror by Richard LaBeviere, China has not been spared. Xinjiang, southern China, has a population that is 55% Uyghur, a Turkophone Sunni ethnic group. It has been confronted with Islamist violence since the beginning of the 1990s. Created in 1955, Xinjiang, which means new territory, is one of the five autonomous areas of China and is the largest administrative unit of that country. The area is highly strategic at the geopolitical level. Chinese nuclear tests and rocket launches take place at the Lop Nor test grounds, as well as from an economic standpoint, since it abounds in natural wealth, oil, gas, uranium, gold, etc. Against this backdrop, attacks have proliferated by independence-seeking cliques, all preaching holy war. Some are acting in the name of Turkish identity, while others are fighting in the name of Allah, especially in the southern part of the region. As in the rest of Central Asia, in Xinjiang we are witnessing the rising influence of Wahhabi groups and the increasing proselytism of preachers from Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. Traditionally allied with popular China, Pakistan is nevertheless trying to extend its influence to this part of China, using the Islamists as it did in Afghanistan. For this reason, Beijing closed the road from Karakoram connecting Xinjiang to Pakistan between 1992 and 1995. Since 1996, the frequency of the incidents has skyrocketed. In February of 1997, riots exploded in Yining, a town of 300,000 inhabitants located to the west of Urumqi near the Kazakh border. This violence caused 10 deaths, according to Chinese authorities, and the Uyghurs have counted more than 100 victims. Every week in 1998 saw a bombing or an attack with automatic weapons. The region's hotels, airports, and railway stations are in a constant state of alert. In April, Chinese authorities in the vicinity of Yining seized 700 cases of ammunition shipped from Kazakhstan. In September, the secretary of the Xinjiang Communist Party declared that, quote, 19 training camps in which specialists returning from Afghanistan educate young recruits in the techniques of terrorism with the assistance of the Taliban, unquote, were neutralized. In January 1999, 29 activists implicated in the February 1997 riots were arrested. On February 12th, violent clashes between the police and groups of Uyghur militants wounded several dozen people in Urumqi. 200 people were arrested, and in early March, 10,000 additional soldiers arrived at Yining to beef up security, while in Beijing, the Uyghur Islamist organizations took credit for several bomb attacks. This Asian testbed is supporting the emergence of a new type of radicalism. Sunnite and ideologically conservative, it is supranational in its recruitment and in its ideology. It does not emanate out of scissions in the great Islamist organizations, but from a radicalization of the Afghan Talibans, from their sanctuaries and their ties with small terrorist and mafia groups, marginalized and radicalized by repression, as in Egypt and Algeria, in a context of economic and financial globalization, as well as from the circulation of militants who have lost their territories. Consider the possibility of utilizing the Uyghurs and Taliban connections either to split off and destabilize Xinjiang or perhaps to prod the Chinese into a more cooperative policy with regard to sharing the development of their resources. The Chinese have specifically charged Al-Qaeda and bin Laden with involvement with the Uyghurs. This charge carried in, among other papers, the New York Times of Tuesday, January 22nd of 2002. An article by Elizabeth Rosenthal, datelined Beijing, January 21st, headlined, Beijing says Chinese Muslims were trained as terrorists with money from bin Laden. Seeking to justify its harsh treatment of Muslims living in China's far western region of Xinjiang, Chinese officials asserted today that a small separatist movement there was being financed and supported by Osama bin Laden, and that more than 100 terrorists who had trained at camps in Afghanistan had been arrested in China. In a new report, the government asserted that Mr. bin Laden himself had met with radical Chinese Muslims and that, quote, bin Laden terrorists and Taliban leaders, unquote, had allocated, quote, a fabulous sum of money for the training of the East Turkestan terrorists. Backup of that, the Chronicle of Monday, January 28th of 2002, article by Ellen Nickmeyer of the Associated Press, U.S. forces clash with Al-Qaeda gunmen. Skipping down, in December, two of the gunmen were captured when soldiers used the only doctor the men trusted to trick them. The captured men were handed over to U.S. forces, who have set up a military base at the Kandahar airport. They were both Chinese, presumably militant Uyghurs, demanding independence for their Muslim-dominated northwest province of China. Now, consider also the manipulation of the Indian-Pakistani conflict and the well-documented connections between al-Qaeda and the Taliban and the Pakistani secret services. Al-Qaeda appears to have utilized the hostilities between India and Pakistan, and specifically an attack on the Indian parliament. That has apparently helped to make the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan more porous, and it may make it more porous still. Financial Times of Friday, December 21st of the year 2001, an article by Farhan Bokhari in Lahore, Pakistan. This is headlined, Kashmir Could Trigger Al-Qaeda Escape. Pakistan could immediately move thousands of troops from its western border with Afghanistan in the event of an Indian attack in Kashmir, although this would leave a large gap for al-Qaeda fighters to enter the country, senior government officials and analysts said yesterday. One question to ask is that whether perhaps that al-Qaeda attack on the Indian parliament, which obviously made the Pakistani-Indian confrontation more tense, may have been intended to do exactly that. Interestingly, Austria also appears to be an area where al-Qaeda fighters are heading for as a place of refuge. This might be considered sort of a far western front, just as the India-Pakistan situation might be considered the opening up of a southern front and a southern escape route if, in fact, tensions escalate with the results speculated about there. The San Francisco Chronicle of January 22nd of the year 2002 had an article by Eric Geiger headlined, Austrian Border Offers al-Qaeda a New Gateway to Europe. Thanks to a little-known Austrian court decision, hundreds of illegal immigrants are pouring into Western Europe virtually every week without hindrance, fugitive Afghan Taliban fighters, and members of Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda terrorist network, allegedly among them. Skipping down. The gateway for the influx is a 65-mile stretch of border between Austria and Slovakia that is normally closely monitored. Now, we're going to be talking about Austria and some of its politics vis-a-vis the Middle East, and in particular, a fellow named Jörg Haider. First, note the following article. This is excerpted from For the Record program number 306. There was a very interesting article that appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle about an Iraqi arms dealer who serves as a conduit of aid from the far right and explicitly fascist elements in Europe to Saddam Hussein and Iraq. This article was published in the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, May 3rd of the year 2001. It's by Eric Geiger of the Chronicle Foreign Service. It's headlined, Convicted Arms Dealer Funnels Aid from Europe's Far Right to Iraq. Subtitled, Austrian German Neo-Nazi Groups Are Fans of Hussein. And it's datelined, Sowjet unter Glan, Austria. The article reads in part, Until recently, residents of this sleepy village took little notice of a portly, middle-aged Arab businessman living inconspicuously on the edge of town with his family, assuming him to be a successful carpet dealer. but Austrian media, citing security authorities, identified Abdulmonem Jebara, J-E-B-A-R-A, 60, as a convicted Iraqi arms dealer allegedly acting as Saddam Hussein's liaison with sympathetic far-rightist groups in Europe. Quote, he calls himself a mere export and import trader, but Austrian and German security agencies see Jebara as a pivot of an alarmingly close cooperation emerging in recent months between extreme rightists in the two countries and radical Islamists, unquote, said Vienna's usually well-informed and influential news magazine, Format. From his hilltop bungalow sporting satellite dishes and surveillance cameras, Jebara allegedly is coordinating unspecified aid programs from a network of far-rightist supporters in Europe for Iraq, which is still under UN sanctions imposed in 1990 after its invasion of Kuwait. What seems to unite the European far-rightists and the Iraqis are their common anti-Semitic and anti-American sentiments. In its latest report on the rightist scene in Germany, the Agency of the Protection of the Constitution, a sort of German FBI, said, quote, the American democratic system is seen by the two groups as an expression of cultural decadence and economic imperialism, unquote. A recent debate in Austria's parliament seemed to suggest that since settling in St. Viet, near Klagenfurt in Carinthia province in the early 1990s, Jebara has enjoyed the protection of high-level politicians who are aware of his activities and background. Quote, how is it possible that a man of Jabara's caliber, who is known to have close contacts to the extreme rightist and the Iraqi Secret Service, and served part of a six-year sentence for arms dealing, blackmail, and tax evasion in Germany, was allowed to settle in Austria, unquote, thundered Karl Ohlinger, a prominent opposition Green Party lawmaker. Austria's 15-month-old center-far-right coalition government quickly passed the buck, saying that attempts to start deportation proceedings against Jebara have always been thwarted by Carinthian authorities. Jörg Haider, founder of the far-right Freedom Party and still its driving force, is Carinthia's governor. In an interview last week, Haider insisted that provincial authorities have no power to block proceedings related to federal alien laws. Please note that Jabara's base of operations is in Carinthia province, and the governor of Carinthia is Jörg Haider. Umberto Bossi of the Liga Nord in Italy, part of the Berlusconi coalition that I alluded to earlier in this broadcast, is also very closely allied with Jörg Haider, whose xenophobic anti-immigrant arguments have sounded a resonant theme and a very sympathetic note in much of the European Union. And they also echo themes that one hears from far-right and fascist elements in the United States as well. Returning to this Chronicle article, in an interview last week, Haider insisted that provincial authorities have no power to block proceedings related to federal alien laws. He also denied media reports quoting Jebara as saying he knows Haider well. Quote, I'm vaguely familiar with the case, but I have never met that man, Jebara, and never had any contact whatever with him. I am being blamed for just about everything these days, unquote. Among those reportedly spearheading the effort to funnel aid to Iraq is Germany's National Democratic Party, which openly woos skinheads and sponsors annual protests marking the 1987 death in prison of Hitler deputy Rudolf Hess that often wind up in neo-Nazi violence. The party, which all German Democratic parties seek to ban, recently proclaimed, quote, strong support for suffering Iraqis, unquote, on its internet homepage. Again quoting, the so-called Community of Nations Against Iraq is a structure held together by means of blackmail, lies, bribery, corruption, and violence by the satraps of the East Coast, the statement said, using a term far-rightists usually apply to the U.S. Jewish community. Also regularly expressing, quote, solidarity, unquote, with Hussein's regime is the Munich weekly Deutsche National Zeitung. Circulation, turning to the inside of this article, 130,000, 115,000 in Austria. Its owner is Bavarian millionaire publisher Gerhard Frey, leader of the German People's Party, DVU, a group accused of racism and anti-Semitism that won 13% of the 1998 vote in the eastern state of Saxony-Anhalt. By the way, we've spoken about Gerhard Frey in numerous broadcasts. He's an individual with more connections, as I say, than a switchboard. He was one of the major funding conduits for Vladimir Zhirinovsky's early political rise in Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union. It was in the Deutsche National Zeitung and Soldatenzeitung that the disinformation that Lee Harvey Oswald shot at allegedly shot at General Edwin Walker was first published. This several days before that information supposedly first surfaced to the light of day in an interview that Marina Oswald gave to the FBI. Returning once again to this article, after discussing support for Jabara and for Saddam Hussein with by Gerhard Frey, in an editorial, speaking of the Deutsche Nationalzeitung, in an editorial, the weekly attacked the United States for keeping Iraq in a, quote, stranglehold, unquote, and asserted that Germany spent $18.8 billion in tax money to help finance the Persian Gulf War, quote, even though Germany was in no way threatened by Baghdad, unquote. The publication also ridiculed as ludicrous horror stories, unquote, recent media reports that the German intelligence agency has new evidence that Hussein has revived his nuclear weapons production and may be capable of making an atomic bomb within the next 3 years. Openly pitching for cash for our Iraqi brothers, unquote, are leaflets issued by a shadowy organization calling itself German and Austrian Patriots, unquote. The flyer's signatories include Franz Schoenhuber, 78, the former Waffen-SS sergeant who co-founded the once surging extreme-rightist Republikaner Party, and the leader of a Salzburg-based neo-Nazi group identified only as Richard R. Security officials say funds and commodities collected for Iraq on humanitarian grounds, unquote, are usually channeled to Jeanine Le Pen, the wife of Jean-Marie Le Pen, the leader of France's far-right National Front. Running a special aid organization called SCS, Children of Iraq, she then arranges for the transfer to Baghdad. The idea of helping Saddam Hussein seems to have a bizarre unifying effect on assorted extreme rightist groups, not only in Austria and Germany, but also in the rest of Europe, unquote, said the Austrian security official. Apparently, that's where Hussein's man in St. Viet comes in. That is the reference to Jabara. That reference, I should say, is to Jabara. In an impassioned plea for donations for Iraq, published recently by the Austrian far-rightist periodical Rule, Jabara was named as, or Rule, maybe that's not anglicized, the Austrian far-rightist periodical Rule. Jabara was named as, quote, coordinator for the aid action for Iraq by German patriots, unquote. Questioned about it by Austrian reporters in January, Jabara not only did not deny his role as aid coordinator, unquote, but also minced no words about his admiration for Hussein and proudly showed off a wristwatch whose dial showed a portrait of the Iraqi despot. Quote, the Iraqi people are starving, our children are starving, and Bill Clinton, then U.S. president, is much worse than Hitler, he said. The people helping us are just ordinary young people who finally recognize what the truth is, and besides, their ideology resembles ours, unquote. By the way, I would also note the considerable sympathy for Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi position in the American left as well. It's one of the reasons why one finds far more overlap between elements generally regarded as on the left and on the right than one might suspect. Continuing. Jabara, a former resident of Munich, was sentenced in 1986 to 6.5 years in prison for attempting to smuggle 40 combat helicopters from Germany to Iraq during the Iran-Iraq War, as well as for trying to blackmail a business partner. The verdict specifically referred to Jabara's, quote, close contacts, unquote, with high-level Iraqi government and Secret Service officials, including Hussein's top security officer and the chief of the National Procurement Agency, unquote. According to Format, Jabara also was questioned in the court in connection with the reported participation of German firms in the construction of chemical weapon plants at Iraq's heavily guarded Samarra industrial complex. The magazine said he was accused of engineering a hostage-taking plot in Iraq to force his release from prison. Jabara has vehemently denied both allegations. Jabara was prematurely released from prison for unknown reasons in the early 1990s, and his motive for moving to Austria is also unclear. But some analysts point out that before the Gulf War, Iraq was Austria's most important trading partner in the Middle East, with Austrian exports amounting to about $400 million annually. State-owned and private companies such as Voest Alpine, OMV, and ELIN, all in capitals, E-L-I-N, did large-scale business in the fields of manufactured goods, oil, and power plant construction, respectively. The Gulf War and the embargo ended the Austrian-Iraqi trade almost completely, and that's why it was with satisfaction that the easing of the sanctions in recent years was registered here, unquote, said the Vienna Daily Standard. That again from the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, May 3rd of the year 2001. And again, we've talked about Saddam Hussein and some of the fascist antecedents of Iraqi extreme nationalism. There was an anti-British pro-Axis uprising in Iraq led by Ali Rashid in 1940, I think it was. It was during World War II, and I believe off the top of my head it was 1940. One of Ali Rashid's supporters was an Iraqi army officer named Karula al-Tufa, who is the uncle of Saddam Hussein and who was Saddam Hussein's mentor, political mentor, to a large extent. Saddam Hussein, by the way, owns Hitler's personal Mercedes, which is said to be his favorite car, and there are areas of overlap between the Ba'ath Party ideology and its extreme racist racial nationalism and the Nazi Party ideology of Adolf Hitler. I'm not saying the two are identical, but there are areas of overlap in the doctrinaire militarism, the worship of war, and also the extreme racial nationalism that infect both philosophies. And again, Karula al-Tufa was the most important political influence on Saddam Hussein, and he was an admirer of Hitler and was a participant in the Ali Rashid uprising against the British in 1940. That, once again, excerpted from For the Record program number 306. There will be a detailed annotated description of For the Record 348 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. Within the description for the Record 348, there will also be links to two websites maintained by sister station WFMU. WFMU.org/Dave Emery has more recent For the Record programs streaming. There is a longer URL which has virtually the entire For the Record series available for download only on Real Audio. That concludes For the Record 348, Side 1, being recorded on February 17th of 2002. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening. Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program 348, titled Machiavelli 101. This is being recorded on February 17th of the year 2002, and we're going to continue with our discussion of the, at times, I think, deliberate promotion of ethnic and geographical polarities for an altogether cynical and fascistic purpose. This also in the context of a multinational corporate policy, which may be relatively short-sighted, in some ways Machiavellian itself, but within which I suspect the underground Reich, as I have called it, cementing powerful elements in this country, Europe, and the Middle East, is working to not only eclipse American power, but to bring about the annihilation of Israel and world Jewry in keeping with the doctrine of the underground Reich. Now, in the first side of this broadcast, we took a look at, among other things, the fact that, according to European intelligence officials, Al-Qaeda was now in the process of making entry as a place of refuge into Austria. And that is a very interesting place indeed. Not only is Austria not a place that has a large Middle Eastern population, but one of its most prominent politicians, the neo-fascist Jörg Haider of the Freedom Party, an individual that we've spoken about many times in the past, has been very active in promoting Austrian political reaction by railing against foreigners. And yet he also is, as we are about to see, making at least diplomatic alliances with elements in the Middle East that are anti-Semitic, Islamo and or Arabo-fascist, to coin a term, and also anti-American. We concluded the first side of the broadcast with a review of an article from the San Francisco Chronicle of May 3rd of 2001. This in turn excerpted from For the Record program 306, recorded on May 16th of 2001, and a top Iraqi-born weapons dealer who has been trafficking weapons to Saddam Hussein and who has served as a political and economic conduit between European neo-fascist elements and Saddam Hussein is based in Carinthia in Austria. Jörg Haider is the governor of Carinthia in Austria. And bear in mind that Al-Qaeda, according to European intelligence officials, is retrenching in Austria, among other places, or at least using that as a place of refuge. Now, in that context, consider the following. This is from the London Independent of February 14th of 2002. Visit their website at http://news.independent.co.uk. This article is by Rupert Cornwell in Washington. It's headlined, America Turns on Haider for, quote, encouraging Saddam, unquote. It reads in part, as Washington rattled its sabers still louder against Saddam Hussein, the State Department issued a scathing rebuke of the Austrian right-winger Jörg Haider for his visit to Baghdad this week, saying it would encourage Iraq to be still more intransigent. The stern language of the United States official denouncing Mr. Haider's visit as, quote, inappropriate and counterproductive, unquote, coincided with a new blast against President Saddam by George Bush, who declared the U.S. would do whatever was needed, quote, to defend the American people, unquote. Note Jörg Haider making a visit to Saddam Hussein and formally, at least, visibly allying himself with Saddam Hussein at the very same time that Saddam is under increased pressure from the United States. Saddam Hussein himself, as we looked at, has something of a fascist heritage. His political mentor and uncle, Khairullah al-Tufah, an admirer of Hitler and worked against the British on behalf of the Third Reich in the uprising led by Ali Rashid during the course of World War II. Note also this aspect of Jörg Haider's visit to Saddam Hussein. The Financial Times of Thursday, February 14th of 2002, has the following article by Delia Meth Cohn in Vienna and William Hall in Zurich. It's headlined, Haider stays in the headlines with, quote, private, unquote, visit to Saddam. Skipping down, Haider's latest headline-grabbing move was to pay a visit to Iraqi President Saddam Hussein on what he termed a humanitarian trip. The Iraqis broadcast the visit on TV, claiming it showed the lack of European support for, quote, the U.S. and Zionist conspiracy, unquote. We're going to be taking a look at the alliance between European and American fascist elements and Middle Eastern extremist and fascist elements against not only Israel, but Jews in general, in keeping with the dictates of the underground Reich, which overlaps both elements and I believe in many ways controls them. Consider also, once again, Machiavelli 101. For people who say they don't believe in conspiracy theories, read The Prince by Niccolo Machiavelli, required reading for any introductory poli-sci course, or at least it used to be. Also read The Art of War by Sun Tzu. You don't believe in conspiracy theories? Well, educate yourselves. The New York Times of Thursday, February 7th of 2002, contains the following article by Stephen Erlanger at Stateline Vienna, headlined, Austrian rightist is working on his comeback. And this article reads in part, the biggest problem with Jörg Haider, unquote, the populist right-winger whose party shares power in Austria, again quoting, is that he has two words, Ausländer raus, foreigners out, but we need 2 hours to answer it, said Dieter Bogner, a museum designer and one of Vienna's great and good. Mr. Haider has never actually used those words to insist that foreigners leave. He is more concerned that more do not arrive. But, he, quote, creates a very unpleasant atmosphere, and it takes a lot of time to fight it, unquote, Mr. Bogner said. Now, again, note that Jörg Haider has been very active and very successful, I should say, in mobilizing elements of the Austrian political populace against foreigners, Middle Eastern immigrants in particular. And yet note also that in keeping with his anti-American and anti-Semitic stance, he is now making common cause with Saddam Hussein against the United States and Israel and the, quote, Zionist conspiracy, unquote. We're going to be taking a look at this convergence of sort of a Machiavellian cynicism with international fascism, and we're going to be taking a look at both American and European right-wingers and fascists and how at the same time they are using anti-Arab and anti-Middle Eastern sentiment to mobilize people in Europe and the United States on behalf of their cause, and at the same time they're railing against Israel and Jews and allying with Middle Eastern and Islamo-fascist elements in order to, at least in their eyes, destroy Jews not only in Israel and but also in the United States. At the same time, many of these same elements, as I've said, restating this, are also utilizing anti-immigrant and in particular anti-Middle Eastern immigrant sentiment to mobilize people of European extraction on behalf of their own cause. In that context, the New York Times of Wednesday, January 30th of 2002 should be considered. This is an article by Stephen Erlanger. It's datelined Berlin, January 28th, and headlined, "A jumpy anti-immigrant Europe is creeping rightward." It reads in part, "From Spain to Scandinavia, European politics is drifting to the right. As the economy slows, political parties stressing law and order and stricter controls on immigration are gaining ground, and mainstream conservative politicians are becoming more popular. In the most striking example, a German conservative, Edmund Stoiber, has ridden these issues of economic and personal insecurity hard, opening up a small but persistent lead of 3 percentage points in the opinion polls over the incumbent Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder of the Social Democrats." The article goes on to describe the success in many European countries of right-wing and or neo-fascist parties that have been able to generate a certain amount of political sympathy because of the large influx of people from Middle Eastern and other Muslim countries into Europe. At the same time, as I said, they are also, to a certain extent, allying themselves with Islamo-fascist and or Middle Eastern fascist, Arabo-fascist, to coin a term, elements against the Jews and Israel. Consider the following article from the Searchlight magazine's issue of January of 2002. The Searchlight is a British anti-fascist publication, and this particular article from Searchlight issue number 319, the January 2002 issue, is an article by Devin Burghardt. It's headlined Stateside and subtitled "After the Attacks, American White Nationalism Since September 11th, 2001. What we're going to be looking at, first of all, is the National Alliance. That's the American fascist group that publishes both the Turner Diaries and the book Serpent's Walk that I've used, and their positive response to September 11th. Devin Burghardt writes, "As the tragic events of September 11th unfolded, wannabe white revolutionaries cheered as Jew York City," unquote, crumbled. Even before the Twin Towers had collapsed, one Aryan Nations leader was already celebrating, exclaiming on his website, quote, "May the World Trade Center burn to the ground," unquote, and again quoting, "May the war be started," unquote. Another member advised, quote, "The time for all Aryans to attack is now, not later. Our opportunity may never be the same," unquote. The day after, while thousands of bodies still lay buried in the rubble of the World Trade Center, National Alliance leader Billy Roper commented to members, quote, "The enemy is for now at least our friends. Anyone who is willing to drive a plane into a building to kill Jews is all right by me. I wish our members had half as much testicular fortitude," unquote. By the way, that stance is in some ways reflective of the fascist third position that we've spoken about many times in the past. Continuing, "Focusing blame on Jews in Israel for the attacks, some white nationalists anticipate that anti-Semitism will again find a mass appeal. The World Church of the Creator website, for instance, shows the World Trade Center burning with the caption, quote, 'Friendship with Israel leads to this,' unquote." Though more refined, the white nationalist think tank American Renaissance promotes the same message, quote, "If we go to war, it will not be because we are the land of freedom and opportunity, but because we are the best friend and benefactor of Israel," unquote, noted Jared Taylor. National Alliance members have been distributing a flyer reading, quote, "Is our involvement in the security of the Jewish state worth this," unquote, above a picture of the collapsing towers. William Pierce, the leader of the National Alliance and author of the notorious terrorist Bible, The Turner Diaries, hopes that the American public will begin to blame Jews, which he envisions as a key step towards their extermination. He noted, quote, "The number who will understand where to place the blame will continue to grow, and the demand for a real solution, a final solution, will grow too," unquote. Note again the promotion of the of American support for Israel as a rationale here, not only to perhaps promote anti-Semitism, but ultimately, at least in the eyes of William Pierce, to promote a final solution to the, quote, "Jewish problem in the United States." We're going to be taking a look at recent developments in the Middle East, and that may lead to a, quote, "final solution," unquote, to the Jewish problem, unquote, in the Middle East. What we're going to look at now, however, and considering one of the articles that we looked at in For the Record program number 336, in which we took a look at 22 different affidavits alleging contact between Timothy McVeigh, the now executed conspirator in the Oklahoma City bombing, and Middle Eastern men. There were 22 separate affidavits, bearing in mind that someone who was denied the opportunity to testify at McVeigh's trial was a fellow named Edwin Angeles, who described apparent contacts between Terry Nichols, McVeigh's co-conspirator, and Ramzi Youssef, an Al-Qaeda milieu associate and the person convicted of the first attack on the World Trade Center, these attacks taking place in the Philippines. We took a look at that in For the Record program 330, among other broadcasts. Program 330. We're going to take a look now at a hypothetical development that took place in the Deep South. Obviously, that is an area where white supremacist groups are very active. The National Alliance itself is based in West Virginia. There have been reports of new attacks that are being proposed by Al-Qaeda. The following article is from the New York Times of Thursday, February 14th of the year 2002. This is an article, an AP story, Dateline Memphis, February 13th. The headline is A Suspicious Death. Crash Adds Mystery to an Inquiry. Listen very carefully to the following article and consider the association and the place. This is Dateline Memphis, February 13th. The focus of an investigation into a fraudulent driver's license scheme with possible terrorism ties has shifted to the death of one of the people who was charged in the scheme. The person, Catherine Smith, was killed in a fiery crash early Sunday, a day before her hearing in federal district court here. Ms. Smith, 49, was burned beyond recognition, and a prosecutor described the crash as, quote, most unusual and suspicious, unquote. Now, it's not clear, interrupting briefly, it's not clear from the article what ethnic background Ms. Catherine Smith was, but listen to the identity of the people that she was associated with and consider that this is the Deep South. Ask yourself how probable this is. Continuing, was it an accident? Was it a suicide? Or was it something else? An FBI spokesman, George Bold, said. Ms. Smith's car hit a utility pole in a rural area just north of the Mississippi state line. The authorities do not know whether the fire started before or after the crash, but an FBI agent, J. Suzanne Nash, said that the gas tank did not explode and that the car was only slightly dented. Ms. Smith and five men, all Middle Easterners, were charged last week with conspiracy to get Tennessee driver's licenses under false pretenses. In addition, the FBI was investigating whether the men had connections to the September 11th attacks. Three of the men, Mustafa Saeed Abu Shaheen, Abul Musun Mahmoud Hamad, and Mohammed Farez, were charged with trying to obtain Tennessee driving licenses by submitting false information and were ordered detained today in federal court. The two others, Khaled Otla, 31, and Sakera Hamad, 24, were being held without bond after a court hearing on Monday. Ms. Smith and the men were arrested on February 5th. Prosecutors said she had processed four driver's license applications that day based on false information that Mr. Odla provided. Agent Nash said that when Sakera Hamad was arrested, a September 5th visitor's pass for the World Trade Center was found in his wallet. Federal authorities also learned that Mr. Odla drove to Memphis from New York City on September 11th, she said. So what happened to Catherine Smith? The gas tank to her car did not explode, and the car was only slightly dented, but she was burned beyond recognition. She was had been charged with obtaining, attempting to obtain a false ID and driver's licenses for five different Middle Eastern men, and two of the men, Sakera Hamad, had a September 5th visitor's pass for the World Trade Center, and Mr. Odla had driven to Memphis from New York City on September 11th. As I'm recording this on February 17th of the year 2002, one should note that there have been new alerts of possible Al-Qaeda attacks. I would also note that Tennessee is where the Tennessee Valley Authority is located. There are nuclear facilities there. I would also note that George Bush is not exactly winning a lot of foreign policy points with regard to his axis of evil speech. There is no proof whatsoever that Iran was connected to Al-Qaeda in the September 11th attacks. There have been contradictory accounts of a possible Iraqi involvement, but nothing has ever been proved. And North Korea sure as hell wasn't involved in September 11th. And a lot of people have been very critical of George Bush identifying these three countries as the axis of evil. And I would also point out that he has not said anything about Saudi Arabia, and the evidence linking Saudi Arabia to the attacks is beyond dispute. And I would, you know, apparently there are not any Iranian, Iraqi, or North Korean participants in the Carlyle Group. I would also note that Iran has now decided to turn over some Al-Qaeda activists, not to the United States, but to Saudi Arabia. The Financial Times of Wednesday, February 13th of 2002, had an article by Guy Dinmore in Tehran headlined, "Iran poised to send home terrorism suspects." Skipping down, "He declined to identify the prisoners," this an Iranian spokesman, "but said the Taliban members would be given soon to Afghanistan's new interim administration, while the suspected Al-Qaeda activists would be handed to authorities in their home countries," which included Saudi Arabia. Personally, I think that including Iran, for all of its shortcomings and its documented history in the past of promoting Islamic fundamentalist terror, the Iranians are Shiites and the Al-Qaeda are Sunnis, and I think this is a very, very foolish gambit, and there are those who are agreeing. Now, consider again Machiavelli 101. Consider what I have called the Underground Reich, and I believe that the Bush administration is a front for the Underground Reich. I think George Bush himself is just a puppet. I don't think he has any real power. I think he does what he is told. The San Francisco Chronicle of February 17th of 2002 had the following article by Chris Matthews, a Chronicle columnist, called "Who Hijacked Our War?" And he's talking about the diversion of the public outrage and commitment after September 11th to something which really doesn't have very much at all to do with the attacks on the Pentagon or World Trade Center. Speaking of Bush's axis of evil, "It's driven Iran's President Mohammad Khatami, a moderate, into the welcoming arms of the zealots and millions of Iranians to the streets with renewed shouts of death to America," unquote. "It's given Saddam Hussein a golden chance to pledge support for Iran, a country with which he fought an 8-year war should it come under American attack. It has exposed Israel to an Iraqi missile barrage in the event of a U.S. attack." Even before the axis of evil, unquote, speech, the chief of Israeli intelligence, General Amos Malka, said that if the United States tries to overthrow Hussein, Iraq would probably launch missiles at his country. Think again about the National Alliance, and think about Jörg Haider and other European and American neo-fascists and their connections with some of the very Middle Easterners that they despise. And consider also the arrest of Catherine Smith, now burned to death, burned beyond recognition in a suspicious car accident, who was going to obtain driver's licenses for five Middle Easterners. Is there an underground Reich attack planned for the United States? And is the Bush administration deliberately trying to, as I have said in the past, work on behalf of the underground Reich, utilizing dupes as well as knowledgeable conspirators to isolate and or destroy the United States, to perhaps drive it out of the Middle East, certainly discredit it, and also to annihilate Israel and world Jewry? In considering the axis of evil, consider who helped to arm Iran and Iraq, and when these countries were getting their start, so to speak, as terrorist axes of evil, this in the early 1980s. Reviewing information we've dealt with in past broadcasts from the book The Secret War Against the Jews, co-authored by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens. This book published in hardcover by St. Martin's Press, copyright 1994. One top secret national security decision directive, NSDD number 3, established a new intelligence organization for Vice President George Bush. The former CIA director now had become the head of his own separate spy agency in the White House. Again, quoting here from a document. The Special Situation Group, or SSG, chaired by the vice president, is charged inter alia with formulating plans in anticipation of crises in order to facilitate this crisis pre-planning responsibility. A Standing Crisis Pre-Planning Group, or CPPG, is hereby established and will, for each potential crisis, ensure that an interagency group is established and developing contingency plans, providing guidance to the group and task it with the preparation of preemptive policy options to prevent a crisis if possible, as well as the preparation of politico-military options for dealing with the eventual crisis. That again from once top secret National Security Decision Directive, NSDD number 3. The authors go on to add, it is clear from this top secret document that Bush asked for and received authorization to prepare, quote, preemptive policy options, unquote. And skipping down, in short, George Bush's job was to coordinate the State Department, CIA, military, and any other government agency in preparation for another terrorist attack or hostage crisis. No one but Bush was responsible for the disasters to come. Skipping down. When it came to terrorism or the Contras, Bush's Special Situations Group had the final say. To put it bluntly, Bush was running a White House within the White House. Its members could co-opt or circumvent any government agency they wished. There would be no leaks, but unfortunately no independent criticism of their plans either. The Vice President's SSG was the perfect hiding place for some of the bizarre operations dreamed up by Bush, Casey, Robert Bud McFarlane, Dewey Claridge, and North. Our intelligence sources say that these five men are the, quote, morons, unquote, who bungled their way into the Iran-Contra affair and then tried to shift the blame to the National Security Council or to Israel, even to Ali North, anywhere but back to the office of the vice president, unquote. And that same pre-crisis planning group was also used by George Bush to arm Saddam Hussein. And he did so in cooperation with William Casey. Turning once again to the secret war against the Jews, according to Alan Friedman's book Spider's Web, Vice President Bush played a covert role in Casey's Iraq initiative. Like Perry's discussion of Cambodia, Friedman makes a powerful case that Bush was inextricably intertwined with Casey's bizarre initiative to buy Iraqi oil and Hussein's allegiance with guns. There is no doubt that transferring American weapons to Iraq was highly illegal, but was approved by both Bush and Casey. It was also hidden from both the Secretary of State and Congress. Both times Casey and Bush teamed up, the operation involved gun running. It is no coincidence that both secret operations began in 1982, the same year that Vice President Bush established his Special Situations Group for Counterterrorism. What neither Perry nor Friedman realized was that Bush and Casey worked together on a third covert operation, the Arms for Hostages deal with Iran. According to our sources, the story of Bush's role as the secret architect of Irangate has never been told before. It was run just as poorly as the Cambodian gun-running operation and just as illegal as the arming of Iraq, but it was much better hidden from Congress, unquote. Note again the elder George Bush and his special private intelligence agency created as a result of the counterterrorism task force that he chaired, used in the early 80s to arm both Iraq and Iran, the axis of evil. It'll be interesting to see whether there will be a, quote, final solution, unquote, to the Jewish problem in Israel as a result of, ultimately, this sort of liaison. The programs I've recorded over the years are available from a CD and tape duplication service called Spitfire, one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They can be reached at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. Email mail at spitfirelist1word.com. Visit their website at www.spitfirelist.com. By the time you hear this program, there will be a detailed annotated description of the program in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. Be sure to follow the links in that description to two websites maintained by sister station WFMU-FM, which have virtually the entire For the Record series available for download and or streaming on Real Audio. The first airing of each For the Record program takes place at 9 p.m. on Monday night on KKUP. Visit their website for instructions on how to listen at www.kkup.com. This concludes For the Record program number 348, Machiavelli 101. This is being recorded on February 17th of 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.
And broadcasting from Jersey City, this is WFMU East Orange, WXHD Mount Hope, online at WFMU.org. Dave Emery will be back next Tuesday, 6 o'clock p.m. Coming up at 8 o'clock, Sue Braun filling in for Tom Sharpling. Right now, though, we go to Studio B for Mac and the Antique Phonograph Music Program.
How do you do, everybody? How do you do? How do you do, everybody? How are you? We are here, we must confess, just to bring you happiness. Hope we'll please you more or less. How do you do? How do you do? How do you do? How do you do? Do, 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 do. Billy Jones and Ernie Hare wish to say to you out there, how do you do? Do, 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 do. How do you do, Billy Jones? How do you do?
Pretty well. How do you do, Ernie Hare? How do you do?
Pretty good. Bill, I hope you like the song.
Well, I hope it's not too long. Am I right?
No, you're wrong. How do you do? How do you do?
How do you do?
How do you do?
How do you do?
How do you do? Do, 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 do.
Well, I'm glad you're nearly done.
Why, I've only just begun. How do you do? Do, 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 do. How do you do, everybody? How do you do? How do you do, everybody? How are you? When the skies are kind of gray and you're feeling just that way, ain't it great to hear folks say, how do you do? How do you do? How do you do? How do you do? Do, 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 do. So from Maine up to Alaska, here is what we want to ask you. How do you do? Do, 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 do. How do you do, old-timers? How do you do?
Hello, old-timers.
How do you do, old-timers? How are you? How are you? How are you? You remember way back when girls were girls and men were men. It's so different now from then. How do you do? How do you do?
How do you do?
How do you do?
How do you do?
How do you do? Do, 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 do. Even grandma bought their hair, they also smoke and learn to swear. How do you do, 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 do. John Chinaman, how do you do?
Hello, John.
How do you do, John Chinaman? How are you?
How are you, Johnny?
Run the laundry, eat chumming, coffee, suey, everything. Glad you like to hear a sling. How do you do? 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 How do you do, Mr. Rooster? How do you do? How do you do, Mr. Hen? How are you?
when you haven't laid the floor to win. How do you do? How do you do? How do you do? How do you do? You think you're getting by, soon you'll be a chick and pie. How do you do, 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 do? Goodbye, Edison fame. Goodbye. Goodbye, Edison fame. Goodbye. Billy and Ernie are nearly through singing this little song to you. Now we'll say goodbye to you. How do you do? 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 Do, 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 do. Hope you like this little song. Now it's time to say so long. So goodbye, bye, 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 bye. Goodbye.
All right, well, how do you doody doody do 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 from the Happiness Boys. What a wacky little record there. Well, good evening, friends. Here I am, your host, Mac, back with another edition of the Antique Phonograph Music Program. Tonight with my special guest, Bill Stock. How are you, Bill?
How do you doodle doodle do, Mac? I doodle good, huh?
I doodly doodle. You're not thinking about making me into a chicken pie.
No,
that's not
I don't
some
think
kind of
so.
Message you were sending to me subtly through that record. They were talking about that rooster, right?
Absolutely.
But a rooster would make a very good chicken pie, would it?
I don't
be a little
think
tough.
So. I don't think so.
I don't know.
And you're right, that was Billy Jones and Ernie Hare, the Happiness Boys, and you're getting a little taste of what radio was like back in 1925 when
really?
That Blue Ambrol cylinder was made, because they had a weekly radio program. They were called the Happiness Boys because they were sponsored by the Happiness Candy Company, if you can believe this. And part of their little song used to go, don't forget our Friday date, 7:30 until 8. How do you doodly doodly do? So
nice.
Anyway.
Was that their show?